Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a senior UN human rights official told the BBC that there is a plausible case that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza, a war crime. Meanwhile, U.S. citizens struggle to make sense of White House policy that seems to call for getting aid to Palestinians while pursuing a course of action that makes that aid necessary, if insufficient. Phyllis Bennis is senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, an international advisor with Jewish Voice for Peace, and a longtime UN watcher. She joins us with thoughts on the evolving situation. Also on the show, as reporter Alex Salmon outlined 5 years ago in the American Prospect, the Boeing scandal is an exemplar of the corporate crisis of our age. Putting resources that should have been put into safety, into shareholder dividends and stock buybacks, selling warning indicators that alert pilots to problems with flight control software as optional extras, and outsourcing engineering to coders in India making $9 an hour. These weren't accidents. They were choices made consciously over time. So why are media so excited about Boeing CEO stepping down, as though his taking one for the team means changing the playbook? We'll hear from Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Reuters reported on March 22nd that the United Nations Security Council had rejected a resolution proposed by the U.S. calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and a hostage deal between the Israeli government and Hamas. Russia and China vetoed the measure, readers were told, while Algeria also voted no and Guyana abstained on a measure that, quote, called for an immediate and sustained ceasefire lasting roughly 6 weeks that would protect civilians and allow for the delivery of humanitarian assistance, close quote. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Linda Thomas-Greenfield, cited in AP, said that the U.S. had been working on a hostage deal for months that would call for a six-week period of calm, from which she said, quote, we could then take the time and the steps to build a more enduring peace, close quote. Well, what does that wording mean? And what do UN resolutions generally mean if politicians and news media interpret them variously? So helping us to sift through these attempts to respond to the violence of Israel's ongoing war on Palestinians in Gaza is Phyllis Bennis. She's senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, an international advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace, as well as author of, among other titles, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Phyllis Bennis.
Great to be with you, Janine.
Well, so the U.S. introduced a resolution at the U.N. nominally calling for a ceasefire, but also vetoed another resolution calling for a ceasefire because Thomas Greenfield said it would interfere with negotiations around freeing Israeli hostages. And then there's this effort to portray the current decision as non-binding. It's very confusing, especially for lay people. Does the U.S. want a real ceasefire or not? What's happening here?
Well, you raise all the right questions, Janine. The real issue has to do with the U.S. view of the United Nations, which is that it's annoying at best and a threat to U.S. domination at worst, mm-hmm. from Washington's vantage point. So that earlier veto by Russia and China and opposition by Algeria, the abstention by Guyana, of the U.S. resolution came after a history, a long history that goes back years, in fact, of the U.S. vetoing calls for a ceasefire in situations when Israel is attacking mostly Gaza, on occasion Lebanon. And the Security Council calls for a ceasefire, and the U.S. says, no, we don't need a ceasefire yet, always meaning we haven't killed enough people yet. Mm-hmm. So there's a long history of that. We don't really have time to go into that. But the U.S. did it twice in a row on the Gaza question, where there were proposals for a ceasefire that the U.S. vetoed, which would have passed, the U.S. refused. Then the U.S. comes up with its own resolution, which was a very, very sneaky one, because that quote that you read about what it says, those words were indeed in the resolution, but it did not call for them. The resolution did not call for an immediate ceasefire. There was a recognition by the Security Council, according to this resolution, that a ceasefire would be a good idea. And then went on to say, and therefore, the Security Council should go on record cheerleading, they didn't use that word, but saying should support the U.S.-controlled negotiations that are already underway in Qatar. So it was a fake resolution. That's why others did not like it and weren't willing to accept it as if it were an actual call. In international law, which is very complicated in a lot of ways, but certain parts of it are pretty clear. One of the parts that's pretty clear, Article 25 of the UN Charter, says that all decisions, all resolutions passed by the Security Council are international law. They're all binding. That's what the real world of international law says. So when a resolution is passed, it needs to say the Security Council demands a ceasefire, period, full stop. If it talks about how the Security Council recognizes that such and such would be a good idea, that's nothing to be binding on,
right?
That's just a statement of what we think is nice. So that's what was distinctive. The new resolution that was passed just a few days ago that the United States was willing to allow to be passed 14-0 with one abstention, the U.S. abstained rather than vetoing it. That was a great step forward. And that one, crucially, did call for an immediate ceasefire. And it also called for the release of all the hostages and compliance with international law in the treatment of all those detained by all sides, which is a clear reference to the Palestinian prisoners that Israel is holding. And it also, crucially, demanded lifting all barriers to the massive amount of humanitarian assistance that's desperately needed as famine is moving across Gaza. So that was a huge shift. At the same time, the U.S. had weakened it in many ways. It removed the word permanent from the description of the ceasefire it was demanding,
right,
and said, we just want a lasting ceasefire. Nobody knows what that means. And crucially, the other weakness was that the ceasefire is only called for 2 weeks. It said that the ceasefire should last for the month of Ramadan. But it was passed 2 weeks into Ramadan, so there's only about 2 weeks left.
Right.
So that's way too short. And there's other limitations as well. But it was a very significant shift in the U.S. position, and it really speaks to how the Biden administration is hearing, if not yet fully responding to, but feeling like they have to answer the demands of this rising movement that is so powerful across the United States and now globally, saying we need a ceasefire now and we need access for massive amounts of humanitarian aid without any of the barriers that Israel is putting up. Those things are desperately needed.
Yeah.
And what we're looking at now is a question of how that movement is rising, what the impact could be on the elections. That's one of the biggest pressure points for the Biden administration. If they want to win this election, they have to be seeing that the only way to do it is to change their policy on what has been, up until now, unconditional support for Israel. With all the language about criticisms of Netanyahu and the massive amount of press about how there's this big divide between Biden and Netanyahu, between the U.S. and Israel, that's true only on the level of talking. On the level of acting, the U.S. hasn't changed a thing. $4 billion a year as a starting point of military aid. All the additional weapons that Israel wants, Israel gets. There's just been no shift in the reality that the U.S. is arming and financing a genocide. And as long as that's underway, there's people across this country that are mobilizing this uncommitted campaign in places like Michigan and Minnesota, where those votes really matter. And it's spreading. It's about to happen in Wisconsin. And at the end of the day, this isn't just about the election. This is about what has to happen to stop this genocide. And I think what has to happen is that there has to be a way of convincing Joe Biden personally, not just others in his administration. And right now, the pressure is rising, and the issue is going to be how much longer can he keep up the political credibility when he has people in his own administration resigning in protest of his policies. He has the staff of his own Biden-Harris campaign committee coming out with a public letter saying, Mr. President, we can't do our job. We can't get you reelected with this policy. You have the White House interns. This is my personal favorite of all these protests. Mm-hmm. These are the most ambitious kids in the country. They all want to be president, right? And yet they're willing to come out and say, Mr. President, we are not leaders today, but we aspire to lead in the future, and we can't do it with this kind of a model when there is a genocide underway. So the U.S. can do all it wants to say that this is a non-binding resolution, but that's just not true. They can go out of their way to say that the South African initiative at the International Court of Justice that led to a finding that Israel is plausibly committing genocide right now or is moving towards a genocide, that extraordinary brief prepared by the South African legal team somehow is, quote, meritless. They can claim that, right, but the rest of the world isn't buying it. And increasingly, U.S. voters aren't buying it.
Well, let me just ask you, finally, I do see also just a lot of regular folks reading things like U.S. Deputy Ambassador Robert Wood calling for a lengthy pause to this conflict and saying, well, we're not calling for a pause to the conflict. We're calling for a resolution. We're calling for a way forward, you know, and then you see with concerns about a wider war, we have folks like John Kirby, White House National Security Council, on the Today Show saying, well, quote, we don't want a wider war in the region, but we got to do what we have to do, close quote. This is terrifying, but I also feel like folks are seeing through it. And so maybe let's end on that note, that folks are figuring out that this politics speak, you know, they're seeing it for what it is and, more importantly, for what it isn't.
That's exactly right, Janine. And I think the good news, if there is any, in this extraordinarily devastating time of real genocide in real time in front of our eyes on an hourly basis, the good news is, exactly as you say, more and more people in this country and globally are seeing through those false claims. It's a false claim that the UN resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire is not binding. It is binding. It's a false claim that the South African charges at the International Court of Justice were meritless. They had all the merit in the world. All of these claims are designed to distract us. It's all a distraction. The change in language is a distraction. What we need is a real ceasefire. That doesn't mean 2 weeks to release all the hostages and then we go back to war.
Right.
That's not the point here. The point is to stop the fighting, stop the slaughter, stop the denial of food and water and medicine, which is deliberately causing massive starvation on a level that all of the experts in international humanitarian crises admit is the worst they have ever seen. Not in terms of ultimate numbers, because the population in Gaza is not very big, but in terms of the percentage of people, never have we seen 100% of a population facing extreme hunger, with 55% facing immediate famine. This has never happened before, as long as the international humanitarian organizations have been tracking famines. It's shocking. And the fact that it is going on while we watch with weapons that we provide, that we pay for with our tax money, is finally reaching everybody in this country. More and more people are saying, no, not in our name, not with our tax money, not anymore.
We've been speaking with Phyllis Bennis. You can find her recent work on UN resolutions on Gaza on commondreams.org as well as ips-dc.org. Phyllis Bennis, we have to end it here for today, but of course we'll stay in conversation. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
Boeing CEO David Calhoun is going to step down in wake of ongoing safety problems, as headlines have it, or amid 737 MAX troubles, or elsewhere mishaps. Had you or I in our job made choices repeatedly that took the lives of 346 people and endangered others, I doubt media would describe us as stepping down amid troubles. But crimes of capitalism are accidents for the corporate press, while the person stealing baby formula from the 7-Eleven is a bad person as well as a societal danger. There are many reasons that corporate news media treat corporate crime differently than so-called street crime, but none of them are excuses we need to accept. Public Citizen looks at the same events and information that the press does, but from a bottom-up, people-first perspective. We're joined now by the president of Public Citizen. Welcome back to Counterspin, Robert Weissman.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Well, Boeing is a mega corporation. It has contractors across the country and federal subsidies out the wazoo. But when it does something catastrophic, somehow this one guy stepping down is problem solved. You know, I mean, what happened here versus what, from a consumer protection perspective, you think should have happened or should happen?
Well, I think the story is still being written. Folks will remember that Boeing was responsible for two large airliner crashes in 2018 and 2019 that killed around 350 people. Result of that, as a law enforcement matter, was that Boeing agreed to a leniency deal on a single count of fraud. It didn't actually plead guilty. It just stipulated that the facts might be true and promised that they would follow the law in the future. That agreement was concluded in the waning days of the Trump administration. Fast forward, people will remember the recent disaster with another Boeing flight for Alaska Airlines earlier this year when a door plug came untethered and people were jeopardized. Luckily, no one fatally injured in that disaster. But the disaster itself was exactly a consequence of Boeing's culture of not attending to safety, a departure from the historic orientation of the corporation. And from our point of view, directly a result of the slap on the wrist leniency agreement that they had entered after the gigantic crashes of just a few years prior. So now the Department of Justice is looking at this problem again. They are criminally investigating Boeing for the most recent problem with Alaska Airlines flight 1282. And we are encouraging, we think they are looking back at the prior agreement because the prior agreement said, if Boeing engages in other kinds of wrongdoing in the future, the Department of Justice can reopen the original case and prosecute them more fully, which it should have done, of course, in the initial instance.
Well, let's talk about the DOJ. I'm seeing this new report from Public Citizen about federal corporate crime prosecutions, which we think would be entertained in this case, and particularly a careful look back at choices, conscious choices made by the company that resulted in these harms. And this report says the DOJ is doing slightly more in terms of going after corporate offenders, but maybe nothing to write home about. Yeah.
Right. There was a very notable shift in rhetoric from the top of the DOJ at the start of the Biden administration, and not the normal thing you would hear. Much more aggressive language about corporate crime and holding corporations accountable and holding CEOs and executives accountable. However, that rhetoric hasn't been matched in good policymaking. And we had the lowest levels of corporate criminal enforcement in decades in the first year of the administration. We gave them a pass on that because that was mostly carrying forward with cases that were started or not started under the Trump administration. But we've only seen a slow uptick in the last couple of years. So it has increased from its previous low But by historic standards, it's still at a very low level in terms of aggregate number of corporate criminal prosecutions. By the way, if people are wondering, like, what numbers are we talking about? We're talking about like 113. So very, very few corporate criminal prosecutions as compared to the, you know, million of prosecutions of individuals, as you rightly juxtaposed at the start.
And then even historically, there were more corporate crime prosecutions 20 years ago, and it's not like the world ended. You know, it didn't drive the economy into the ground. This is a thing that can happen.
Correct. The corporate criminal prosecutions don't end the world, and moreover, corporate crime didn't end. So we ought to have more prosecutions than we have now. I mean, we're just talking about companies following the law. This is not about aggressive measures to hold them accountable for things that are legal but are wrong, which is, of course, pervasive. This is just a matter of following the law. There's no sense in which holding corporations accountable for following the law is going to interfere with the functioning of the economy. It doesn't diminish the ability of capitalism to carry out what it does. In fact, following the rule of law, for anyone who actually cares about a well-functioning capitalist society, should be a pretty core principle, and enforcement of law should be a core requirement.
And one thing that I thought notable also in this recent report is that small businesses are more likely to face prosecution. And that reminds me of the IRS saying, well, yeah, we go after low-income people who get the math wrong on their taxes because rich people's taxes are really complicated, you guys. You know, so there's a way that even when the law is enforced, it's not necessarily against the biggest offenders.
Yeah, that's right. Although the numbers are so small,
it's hard to tell.
That disparity isn't quite that stark. I think the big thing that illustrates your point, though, is the entirely different way that corporate crime is treated than crime by individual offenders, street offenders. First of all, the norm for many years has been reliance on leniency agreements. So not even plea deals where you plea down, a corporation pleas down, or a person might plea down the crime to which they are admitting guilt, but a no plea deal in which they just say, hey, we promise to follow the law going forward in the future. And if we do, you won't prosecute us for the thing that we did wrong in the past. Human beings do not get those kind of deals, except rarely in the most low-level offenses. But that's been the norm for corporations for pervasive offenses with mass impact on society, sometimes injured persons, and instances where the corporations, of course, are very intentional about what they're doing, because
right,
it's all designed based on risk-benefit decisions about how to make the most profit. The sentences and the punishments for corporations in the criminal space and for CEOs in the criminal space are just paltry.
So if deterrence, really genuinely preventing these kinds of things from happening again, if that were really the goal, then the process would look different.
Oh. It would look radically different. You know, I think there's a lot of data when it comes to so-called street crime. You need enforcement, obviously, against real wrongdoing, but tough penalties don't actually work for deterrence. It's just not what the system is in terms of the social system and the cultural system, people deciding to follow or not follow the law and so on. But for corporations, deterrence is everything.
Mm-hmm.
They are precisely profit maximizing. They're the ultimate rational actors. If the odds are good that they will be caught breaking the law and suffer serious penalties, then they will follow the law almost to a T. So this is the space where deterrence actually would work. And we see criminal deterrence with aggressive enforcement and tough penalties really missing from the scene. And this Boeing case is the perfect example that the company was responsible through its lax safety processes for two crashes that killed 350 plus people. They got off with a slap on the wrist. As a result, they didn't really feel pressure to change what they were doing, and they put people at risk again. If they had been penalized in that first instance, I think you would have seen a radical shift in the company, a much more adoption of a safety culture. We would have avoided its most recent mishap.
Well, let me finally just bring media back in. You know, there was this damning report from the Federal Aviation Administration last month, and the reporting language across press accounts kind of incensed me. You know, this is just the Seattle Times. A highly critical report, they said Boeing's push to improve its safety culture has not taken hold at all levels of the company. The report, the paper said, cites a disconnect between the rhetoric of Boeing's senior management about prioritizing safety and how frontline employees perceive the reality, close quote. Well, this is corporate crime 101. You know, I mean, there are books written on this. It's not a disconnect, you know. Oh, the company's at war with itself. Leadership really wants safety really badly, but the workers just aren't getting it, you know. This is pushing accountability down, you know, and maintaining deniability at the top. So the CEO doesn't have to say, oh, don't follow best practices here, you know. They just need to say, well, we need to cut costs this quarter. And everybody understands what that means. Anybody who's worked in a corporation understands what corporate climate means. And so I guess my hopes for appropriate media coverage dim a little bit when there is so much pretending that we don't know how decision-making works in corporations, that we don't know how corporations work, when I know that reporters do.
Yeah, well, that is so 100% correct in characterizing what happened at Boeing. Because not only is that fake and obviously culture is set from the top, this is a place where the culture of the workers and the engineers wants to and long did prioritize safety. They're the ones who've been calling attention to all the problems. So right. It's management that's preventing them from doing their jobs, which is what they want to do.
Yeah.
I think in terms of how media talks about this, I agree with your point. And I think the reporting on Boeing has been pretty good in terms of documenting what happened. But what is often missing from even really good reports in the mainstream news media is the criminal justice frame.
Mm-hmm.
Now, admittedly, that partially follows from the failure of the Department of Justice to treat it as a criminal matter seriously. But I think it does change the way people think about this stuff. If you call it a crime, it's exactly as you said, it's not errors, it's not just lapses, it's certainly not mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
These are crimes, and they're crimes with really serious consequences, in this case, hundreds of people dying.
We've been speaking with Rob Weissman, president of Public Citizen. You can find their work on Boeing and many, many other issues online at citizen.org. Robert Weissman, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. You can learn more about FAIR on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.